were talking in the leaders meeting, like, this was just a really hard one. I did not, I had a hard time getting the lecture together. Like, this imperative stuff, the commands, are just kind of hard for me to enjoy or really know what to say very well. But with all that said, I was listening to NPR earlier this week, and they had a story about Inuit parenting, because apparently Inuit parenting is pretty different from, like, traditional kind of American parenting. The Inuits raise their children with, like, virtually no yelling. It's really frowned upon to, like, yell at your kids, which is, like, in great contrast with how I raise my kids and how I influence their behavior. Typical American parenting, you, like, tell your kids what to do, and that escalates until you're yelling, and then they finally surrender and, like, maybe do what you're asking them to do. It's a very logical way of doing it. But the mother in this community was saying that her kids, like, if you're wanting them to do something, rather than, like, approaching it that way, you would tell them sort of this fantastical story. So, like, instead of yelling, don't go close to the water, or, like, put your shoes on, you would, like, tell them a story about, like, this dragon that lives under the water, or this monster that is going to, this is what they said in the thing, the monster that would throw you in a hole if you did not put your shoes on. So apparently, like, it's fine to give them nightmares or whatever, as long as they're doing what you want them to do. But my point is, like, it's not really about, I did think this was interesting regarding parenting, but for here, it's not really about parenting. It got me thinking about, like, what motivates us to change our behaviors. And Christianity, like, not at all uniquely, does that based mostly on a story. And so most of the Bible is about story, much more so than, like, what we have this week with the direct commands. And so what we have are kind of direct commands in this lesson. And these are from Peter to his readers and to us, like, not to do certain things. But I want us to remember before we get started that all of this is on the back of what we have done up to this point. It's all on the back of the indicative truths that we have heard about who Christ is, about who we are, and all of that on the back of this narrative of the whole of the story about who our hero is, all the way from creation and into the New Testament and the Gospels and the death and resurrection and into, like, this room this morning. And so what we talk about, maybe, like, some of it might be uncomfortable or whatever, or it's just different than I think that we approach Scripture a lot of times. But we want to take it all in context, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Okay, so look at your handout if you have a handout. And I have, like, a review up at the top. And the first time I taught, like, I drew, like, a hamburger, and I wasn't going to, like, embarrass myself again by drawing another hamburger. But you basically have, like, three sections to the whole book. You have the, like, indicative truths that kind of come in chapters 1 and 2 about, like, who we are in God's household and how that empowers endurance. And then you have that middle sort of the meat section of chapters 2 through 5. And those are a lot of, like, direct commands about submission in different contexts. And so where we are for our lesson today is technically, like, down kind of in the middle there where it says submit your sensuality. But there's a lot of crossover with what we talked about last week about submitting to suffering and kind of what we see next week with submitting in the church community. And so we get kind of those three elements all mixed in this week. And then you have the bottom bun that we will get to in a couple of weeks about this, the final good news in chapter 5 about how God will exalt and empower the family. We've already talked about, like, the themes of 1 Peter, and basically those are just the who, what, when, where, why, and how of suffering. That's a lot, most of what he's talking about in the whole of the book. All right, and so for today and our lesson this week, let's look at chapter 4 structure. And so our lesson this week is broken up into three main sections. The first section is basically Peter saying, grow up, okay? And so these are a lot of, like, don't do this stuff. And then in the next section, he moves into, like, the stuff that we like. The family ties, you know, like, loving each other, that kind of stuff. And so he's saying, do this. And then in the final section this week, he talks about suffering again, about those growing pains. And he's kind of lays this foundation of because of this. And so that's essentially our, like, structure for our passage this week for chapter 4. Okay, underneath that, in Roman numeral 3, this is that first section, the grow up section, where he's telling us things not to do. And the hardest thing that I had, the hardest thing that I felt about this lesson was that there are a lot of, like, little phrases that are kind of unusual in thinking to us. I think there were places to get kind of caught up in the passage. And so I do not have time to talk about some of the things that I have listed right here. So the issues that we don't have time to discuss, but I put them on the handout if this is something that you want to delve into in your small group. And there are questions in the lesson where she talks about a couple of these things, but there are places that I kind of was, like, a little bit tripped up over that I didn't think she really addressed in the lesson. And so I put them there. If you want to talk about them, you do not have to. But let's talk about kind of what I thought the main idea of that first section was. And that was just how Peter talks about the sin of excess and struggling against some of these Roman impulses. Job's, the Karen Job's commentary that we've been using, it says this. She said, "Pagans of the first century viewed Christians as killjoys who lived gloomy lives devoid of pleasure. And the pleasures from which Christians of the first century typically abstained were the popular forms of Roman entertainment. The theater with its risque performances, chariot races, and the gladiatorial fights with their blood and gore. And Christian lifestyle also condemned the, quote-unquote, pleasures of an indulgent temper, sex outside of marriage, drinking, slander, lying, covetousness, and theft." And so this is like, these would be arenas where they would be interacting with their neighbors. And so this is like friends and family and places where they used to go that as, for them now as Christians, like these are fraught places to go. This would be uncomfortable. It's out of step with what their culture is supposed to be at this point. And if these people are maligning them, then they must know them. These were intimate relationships that they're having to, like, kind of extricate themselves from and kind of break these relationships because of their new beliefs and because of these new behaviors. And so these Job's in her commentary translates that list of vices. I think that's in verse 3. She translates it like this. She calls it acts of abandon, whether that's sex or violence, lust. And then these three, drunkenness, revelry, and carousing, these three are going to refer to, like, the excessive acts of eating and drinking that would have been practiced in pagan worship. And so this would have been like worshiping Bacchus, the god of wine, or at a Saturnalia festival. This was pagan worship, and this was how it was like commemorated, was by doing these sort of things. And then finally with licentious idolatries, and Lisa last week kind of talked about idolatry. And so I want to pause before we go further and note that, like, we feel some of this in being Christians now, but this is really a much, much different, like, cultural situation for these people. The Judeo-Christian values have absolutely shaped, like, what is acceptable adult behavior for Christians and outside of the church, too. So, like, this group of, like, stay-at-home moms, we are not going to be, like, socially ostracized because we're not participating in the neighborhood orgy. Okay, like, even the sound of that is really, like, scandalous, right? But, like, this is what was happening to them. And so we need to recognize, like, this distance between values for these particular churches and kind of what we feel now. So there is a difference. You know, maybe in college you might have felt, or high school, I don't know, you felt, like, a peer pressure to do that kind of thing. But, like, we would frown upon it if, like, a businessman was, like, falling down drunk and vomiting. Like, even non-Christians sort of say, like, this is not adult behavior. And so there's a space there. And, like, we would find more censure if we did these things than if we refrained from them for the most part. So the readers are suffering from, like, the abstaining from these indulgences, but they're also suffering from, like, the social pressure that you are not worshiping in these normal kind of ways anymore. For the original readers, the suffering was that social ostracism, but there's a different kind of suffering about, like, straining against those indulgences. That we probably feel. And so, and feeling like sometimes failing and repenting and trying again in that cycle too. And so another thing that we need to kind of say to kind of undergird this is that I think there's a typical reaction here to sort of make this false duality to sort of, but we are not Stoics in that, like, our God is a God over our physical bodies and over our spirits too. And so just because it's physical and pleasurable does not mean, like, that our God is against those things. Like, he is very much for those things. He's built it into creation. You know, we celebrate with feasting, and the Bible is all about that. So we want to take this, like, in a big context. God is going to make our physical bodies new. We commemorate Christ's death with carbs and alcohol every Sunday. He is about enjoying these things and having them part of his creation. And sex is necessary for the survival of our species. You know, I don't think he is, like, grossly puritanical about, like, celebration in itself, about physical life. And he wants to redeem both of those. He wants to redeem the physical and the spiritual together. They're good gifts. It's just when they get misused. It's just when they get perverted and twisted when it becomes a problem, when they are, like, out of proportion for us. And so that's our danger, is letting these physical things get out of bounds in our own life. And we have this kind of, like, garden temptation that Satan is telling us that God is withholding these things because he doesn't want us to enjoy life or enjoy ourselves. And that is not absolutely not true. We also have, like, a very American kind of lie that we can feast all the time and never fast. And that is kind of what America is about. That we can haven all the time without wildernessing. But we see, like, especially in certain church traditions, that, like, feast and fast are built into our church calendar. We just, Ash Wednesday was just on Wednesday, and so we've just moved into Lent. We've just moved into what is supposed to be sort of like this lean time, and that is true for a reason. And we have these sort of fasting times for to highlight the celebration. It makes the celebration better. It brings contemplation and anticipation to Easter. That's why we're going through Lent, is to prepare us for that in a very similar way to, like, Advent. And so, like, knowing all this stuff, like, why do we crave, like, excess? Why do we lean into it? If we know that we have good things, why would I push kind of beyond that? And when I talk about sensuality, I hope that y'all know I'm talking about, like, five senses, not just our sexuality, but, like, just enjoyment of a lot of different things. But it's any pleasure that's taken, like, to excess, when it becomes idolatry for us, when it's out of bounds, when there's not a concern for other, how it affects other people, there's not a concern for tomorrow. It's just, like, unrestrained food, sex, drink, pleasure, without kind of trying to ignore these toxic effects that, like, naturally happen. And I think for Peter, there's this, like, before and after contrast, where he essentially says, like, you are too old to act this way. And there's, like, this sarcastic tone where he says, you have had plenty of time to behave like this, children. Now it's time to mature. And I think that when we look around in our lives, like, this plays out in a lot of different ways. It could be, like, excessively spending money. Like, am I, like, online shopping constantly? Do I have excessive, like, melancholy? Do you have excessive anger? Are you in orgies all the time? Like, I have enough messes to clean up. But maybe the sensual pleasure is, like, not ever doing it with your husband. That you want to stretch out in your king size bed on your high thread count sheets, and it feels so good. The idol is, like, that no one is going to bother me. And that might be a thing too. But I think that we're attracted to these excesses for different reasons. And some of them are things like that I want to feel more, that I feel bored or I feel lonely, and so I want to increase my pleasure in some kind of way. And then sometimes that I want to feel less, like there is a tragedy or there is a painful thing that's happening around me or to me or in me, and I don't want to feel that. So I'm trying to numb the pain and distract myself from whatever is my reality. And I think that is, it's just very human. And so I heard in a sermon a long time ago that, like, food culture and, like, our obsession with that somebody had this theory that this is a reaction trying to run away from death, that we want to distract ourselves from that reality in our lives. I think that, like, the beauty industry is playing into that too, and how much can I get wrapped up in, like, trying to be youthful, trying to be cute, and, like, I'm never going to age, you know, like, I'm never going to die. I don't want to think about that. And I think that can be underneath a lot of what we do. And so there's this idea that, like, sin is always an attempt to fly away from emptiness. It's always an attempt to, like, fill a void in us. And I think that a lot of times is really true. But sometimes I think that I'm just unthinking, that I just do things because they feel good, that it is just, like, body, being kind of primal, that I want to avoid discomfort and I want to feel pleasure, that the brownies taste good. Like, that's why I eat a lot of brownies. that like sometimes that's just my body. Like I see the brownies, my mouth like starts watering on its own. My stomach starts growling. It wants the brownies. And if my kids make a fuss about it, well, then I'll just have the brownies during nap time. You know, it's no problem. Nobody has to know about my brownie habit, about how much I love brownies. And so what do we do when this excess is accessible to us? And, like, how do you opt out of the brownies when they taste really good? And even when I'm really full, I've been satisfied with the brownies, but I still like that taste in my mouth. And maybe the brownies are like a metaphor for pornography, and maybe the brownies are a metaphor for vodka, or maybe they're not. Maybe it really just is brownies. But it gets super idly. And I think that the eating thing, like, that could be a whole talk for us on its own, right? Like the binging and the purging and the punishing myself for the brownies or whatever, that all of that stuff just is immediately idly. For us. And so what I want to say is I don't think that, like, the hunger necessarily, that the desire is the problem. Like, that is in your body. And I want to be careful how this sounds. I know that this can get dicey. But, like, I tell the kids, like, it's okay if you feel hungry sometimes. Like, right before dinner time, it would be a problem if you did not feel hungry right before dinner time. You are supposed to feel that hunger at that time. If you felt totally full and then were eating dinner, like, that's not healthy. And so I don't think that the hunger is the problem. I think the problem are the empty places and, like, the excess or the disproportion that it takes on. And I don't think that you can totally kill those hungers that come with having a human body, whatever those hungers are. But, like, obviously we have to fill that with the right thing. Like, that should be God filling that hole, that we could enjoy these things without being addicted, without worshiping that, knowing that Jesus is the only thing that's ultimately going to satisfy me. I think it's John 6 where he talks about, I am the bread of life, that with me you'll never hunger or thirst again, that we can find that true satisfaction with him by tasting his goodness. Okay, now, after this, like, I just hate to get legalistic about this stuff, but I didn't know, like, if I'm going to talk about it, like, I wanted to kind of, like, be practical about it too, and so I just tried to think through kind of what it means to, like, stop that stuff in ourselves and how to keep ourselves from going out of bounds, especially when this is, like, a habit. Maybe it's normal for your crowd, when it allows you escape from, like, legitimately hard things from in your life, but to keep it in its right place. And so there's kind of some different parts of this. So we have, like, God's part and what he is doing. And I think the number one thing that we see God do is put up clear roadblocks. And I have seen this many times in my life, that there is a roadblock, there is a consequence, that he's going to alter my life circumstance or allow fallout to not leave me to my own devices. He's going to take action and intervene when I am going off the rails a little bit. He doesn't do it to be mean. He's doing it for protection, clearly. Another side of God's part is that the Spirit's power to go inside of me and to take something that I see as treat and fun and pleasure, and for him to sort of reveal to me that this has gotten gross, like, this is a dangerous or a frightening thing, like, you should, to change kind of how I feel about it too. And I've felt that in my life too. His part is primary. And even, like, our participation is powered by his Spirit. Our power to do any of this is from the Holy Spirit in us, and that the Holy Spirit has revealed certain things to us. And so, but let's kind of turn to our participation and how moderation plays into this. And so we don't want to be legalistic, and there's probably like 30 different flavors of vices in the room. Everybody has their own thing, and so it's hard to generalize about this. But I do think we should, like, you in your own heart can be, like, identifying, like, where are my vices? Like, what is my few things that are, these are, like, typical mistakes that I'm making. It's a habit in my life. And to try to troubleshoot, like, how do I put some blinders on and kind of protect myself? Can you pause your actions and, like, walk away from a thing? Can you, if you know it's a problem, can you just not even go close to it? Can you flee it? Can you put, like, any kind of safeguard around it, like the typical sort of, like, alcoholic doesn't need to work in a bar kind of thing. If I like the ritual of a drink at night, Can I make that? It doesn't need to be a martini every night, you know, or like multiple martinis every night. Can I check some of that stuff? If it's a problem, maybe it's not. Can you put, you know, some of those things, I think that men have to deal with some of this more than we do, but like putting restrictions on your computer, like, is that something that you need to do? If, like, you have a temper with the kids when you're trying to get out the door, can I set my alarm earlier? Like, these are, like, easy things, but can I be deliberate about, like, taking care of myself in this way? I think a huge one is, like, you should definitely be asking people to check in on typical struggles and ask you questions on a regular basis. Even if that stuff, and, like, sometimes I think we just want to cover that up. You know, if this is a habitual problem for me, I do not want anybody to know about it. I definitely don't want people to know about it. And, like, maybe even more so, I don't want people in the church to know about it. And I think that we just need to, like, peel that shame off of it and, like, really understand, like, everybody in here has stuff. Like, everybody is a sinner, like, has their vices. And just to not, like, it doesn't make you stronger to keep it covered up. Like, it only makes you stronger to let that out into the light, to share it with other people, knowing that, like, grace abounds, and that these women in the church are here to help you along the way. So we have, like, outward kind of structures that we can put around, but we can also kind of turn, and I think it's good to look inside of, like, especially in my head, and I think there's a lot of stuff in the passage about, like, mindset. But obviously, to be praying about it, clearly that is powerful to change external stuff and to change internal stuff, to hate our sin, and to catch our innocent, like, daydreaming kind of thoughts. Like, I think it's, like, we browse through all kinds of fantasy, whether that is looking at J. Crew for, like, hours on end. I want to browse through these things and to walk around my house and look at how I want to renovate that thing and how I want to renovate that thing and, like, just get so caught up. And maybe that's not a problem, but sometimes it is. And there is this fine line of, like, a passing thought that goes through your head versus getting fixated on something and knowing, like, is this thing getting weird? Is it getting out of proportion for me? And that 2 Corinthians 10:5 idea of that I'm going to take every thought captive, and if it is going off the rails, that I can maybe try to reel that back in. And that goes right into verse 7, where Peter is talking about the idea of being self-controlled and sober-minded. And I feel self-conscious about talking about this, about the sober-mindedness thing, because I enjoy a beverage and because I make a lot of irreverent jokes. Like, I'm just kind of that way when I feel awkward, and it kind of goes off of, like, it goes weird sometimes. And so I don't feel like I have a grasp on that. So I think this was helpful for me to kind of think through some of this stuff. And I can definitely learn, I can learn here. And Peter's talking about literally, like, about drunkenness, but he's also talking about, like, a mindset of being, like, very clear-headed about, to this specific audience and to us too, but to be clear-headed and to be at the ready and not be clouded with gluttony and lust and indulgence and all of those things. So after all this kind of hard stuff, like, there is repentance and grace. Like, we were looking at this whole story, and that's what the whole thing is about, is that Christ came for that. When you do fail, that he has saved you. Let's get into, we're done with that stuff, but let's move into the family ties section, sort of verses 8 through 11, and this is kind of the fun stuff. But we have this communal imperative to change our behaviors, and there's this urgency and this push into our community where we are with each other and we're using our gifts. I read this book called Connected, and it was about, like, social networks, not just, like, online social networks, but, like, the way that we connect with other people and how that influences our behaviors, and, like, how you met your spouse is really probably, like, a very predictable thing. It's not, like, a random thing because of your social networks. But they have a section in the introduction, and it says this. It's in your handout if you want to follow along. It says, seeing ourselves as a part of a superorganism, so like a colony of bees is a superorganism, and I couldn't help but think about the church, allows us to understand our actions, our choices, and experiences in a new light. If we're affected by our embeddedness in social networks and influenced by others who are closely or distantly tied to us, we necessarily lose some power over our decisions. And such a loss of control can provoke especially strong reactions when people discover that their neighbors or even strangers can influence behaviors and outcomes that have moral overtones and social repercussions. But the flip side of this realization is that people can transcend themselves and their own limitations. In this book, we argue that our interconnection is not only a natural and necessary part of our lives, but also a force for good. That just as brains can do things that no single neuron can do, so can social networks do things that no single person can do. And I think that that is a really wonderful thing to think about in terms of the church, that together, that is such a beautiful thing. And so, of course, we love when Peter starts talking about that love covers a multitude of sins. And we know that he's not talking about salvation. Like, Christ is the thing that, like, eternally covers your sins. But I think that in our relationships with each other, love does cover a multitude of sins. That I can allow, like, if I love you, like, I can allow a lot of leeway when something comes out wrong. And, like, we can just kind of get fuzzy over, like, overlooking, like, these tiny mistakes. We can let the small stuff slide. And that is not letting, that's not saying, like, if there's a big issue in the church that you're just going to let that go, okay? Because that is breaking, that is a relationship that is broken, and that has to be addressed. But in these, like, the way that we are together day to day, that we can be loving in that. And it's the opposite of the idea in Proverbs 10:12, where it says that hatred is stirring up dissension and quarrels. That we're like, just calming that down. And so I think that that is, can be a really great thing. And so much of the letter is about how the family relates to each other, and how we love each other. And, like, it's going to go wrong. Like, it has already gone wrong. Like, I've probably offended, like, 50% of the room at some point in, like, saying a joke or, like, trying to be funny. And, like, just, it just, you're going to hurt each other's feelings. Like, giving people unsolicited advice and that kind of thing. Like, talking about your kids and how smart they are. And people are like, oh, geez. Like, just, will you forgive me? I guess is what I want to say. I'm like, let's just let some of that slide. And know that that we do love each other, and, like, it's okay. We're in it together. And Peter says, like, this is a paramount virtue for the church. And he talks there also about that these relationships are going to include hospitality, so that we want to open our homes and we want to be just allow people in, like, in a literal way, allowing people into your home, but also in a metaphorical way. I'm going to allow you in. And using our gifts to serve each other. And the main ones that he talks about are speaking and serving. And I think that, like, our women do this so well. All right. And then we circle back around, like, with this gift, with this boon of our relationships, we come back around to the suffering. And we come back into it with people on our side. And so he has those last verses, 12 through 19, where he's talking back kind of what we talked about, what Lisa talked about last week with suffering again. And I have listed some other issues that I was having problems with, and I, like, when I was doing the lecture, kind of wanted to go off on these things, but just didn't have time. But if you want to talk about those in small group, great. And so he calls them beloved. He calls them dear friends in this. And so he does have that 15 and 16 where he makes a clear delineation between, like, if you're suffering for, like, murdering someone, then, like, don't do that, okay? But if you're suffering in the name of Christ, like, that is fine. You don't need to be ashamed by that. And so suffering is not, and he kind of goes through these, and he says suffering is not optional. Suffering is not surprising. Suffering doesn't save you. And Job's in the commentary even kind of questions if, like, suffering even always sanctifies you, because sometimes there's, like, bad stuff that spills out of the trauma of your life. And he says that you are not abandoned in your suffering. And so it's hard, like, when we face some suffering, a lot of times we question where God is, and we say, like, are you angry with me? Is this happening because you're angry with me? And so we see Peter, like, correct, like, he normalizes and dignifies Christ's suffering, and that, like, gets transferred onto us. We are really connected to Christ in that kind of suffering. And so there at the end, he talks about that last verse, entrusting your souls to a faithful creator. And so we don't always get a why for our suffering, and we don't always get an end date to our suffering. But we do have the Father's love. We have a brother's sympathy. We have the nurture of the Spirit. We have hope for a different and better future into eternity. We have this visible voice of his word, of the Bible. And we have each other. We have the hands and feet of the church. And, like, what sweet gifts, indeed. And so I just, like, here at the end, I just want to say, like, please speak up if you are suffering or struggling in different vices. And I think there's women all over the church, like our deaconesses and leaders, but a lot of people, even if if it's not those specific people, who will listen without judgment and take your secrets, and will sit with you in difficulty and help you. And if you need to have other help, they'll kind of help direct you to that other help too. And like, if you need it, claim it. And if you can be it, be it. I think that's such a great thing. And I know that I also want to say that for somebody in the real depths of like abuse or depression, like you have those suicide hotlines or just like, just ask for help, just ask for help. And so, but like if you were in that real depth, like a lot of times that's what the thing is that you were in such a fog that you were unable to ask the deaconesses, you were unable to like reach up and ask somebody else. And so I think that we also need to be outward focusing and looking where something does not seem right with this person. And pushing in and asking questions, even if they are really rude, like maybe uncomfortable or impolite questions, that, like, we're very good, we're church ladies, you know, we're good Southern women, and so we don't want to step on toes, and I think that, like, sometimes it can be a nice thing, but, like, I think that things fly under everybody's noses that are really difficult. When we first got married, I used to tell Carter that he's a bully about different things, and he would say, I'm a bully for love, and I want us to be bullies for love, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, push into that stuff, ask the questions about how is your therapy going, how is, like, child X's, like, behavioral thing, how is that going, how is your, like, how is your sex life, like, all these kind of things, how's your drinking, what is going on with your postpartum stuff. Like, can we ask these questions gently with love and take care of each other? And by the Spirit sculpting, like, we are pieced back together and we are gathered in sometimes mangled ways, but for unique good and unique beauty. And all of this, like, the narrative part of the story, the indicative, the imperative, all of that is for our rescue, for our familiarity, for our worship of this great God who submitted his sensuality, gave grace to his siblings, and suffered in order to be glorified. And I'm glad to do it with y'all. Thanks, girls.